Coming up on Star Stuff, fresh questions being raised about the possibility of life on the red planet Mars, more evidence supporting dark energy as the ultimate fate of our universe, and North Korea licks its wounds following the spectacular failure of its controversial rocket launch. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
New questions are being raised about the possibility of life on Mars after scientists at the University of Southern California re-examined test results from NASA's 1976 Mars Viking lander missions. Associate Professor Joseph Miller and colleagues have taken a fresh look at the labelled release experiment, better known as the SOUP test. It involved a scoop of Martian soil being placed in a carbon-14 radio-labelled nutrient-rich cocktail mixture. Now, if there are any microbes in the soil, scientists figured they'd probably metabolize the nutrient and release either carbon dioxide or maybe even methane. And much to everyone's surprise, the experiment gave what can only be described as a clearly positive response. There was a rapid and substantial release of gas, most likely CO2 and possibly other radiocarbon-containing gases. In order to rule out something else rather than biological processes being the cause for this gas release, a second control soup experiment using sterilized soil samples was also carried out, and it produced little or no gas release. However, a problem arose because two other Viking experiments failed to come up with any organic molecules in the soil. So, scientists concluded the positive reaction in the soup test must have been from a non-biological oxidizing chemical reaction, possibly caused by the reactive nature of the soils rather than any perceived biological response. Now, Miller and colleagues have re-examined the test results. They've applied measures of mathematical complexity to the data from both active and controlled Viking tests. They've also applied the same mathematical complexity measures to biological and non-biological data sets here on Earth. Miller and colleagues found the Viking soup test data showed a far higher degree of complexity and order than could reasonably be expected from a straightforward chemical reaction. Miller believes the results most likely mean Viking did discover microbial life on the red planet. He says without a protective atmosphere similar to Earth, life on Mars is more likely to exist underground, where it's safe from ultraviolet radiation. Scientists have already confirmed the existence of frozen water on Mars as subsurface permafrost. And there appear to have been signs of disturbed surface soil where liquid water appears to have briefly flowed before quickly evaporating in the thin Martian atmosphere. Miller says subsurface water ice and perhaps liquid water seem to be happening in regions where large amounts of methane gas also appears to be releasing into the atmosphere. He says water is necessary for life, and methane is a potential signature of biological processes. Professor Miller believes there's enough circumstantial evidence now to strongly suggest that either NASA or the European Space Agency should consider including a purpose-built life detection experiment on their next missions to Mars.
This all started over a decade ago, writing a grant proposal to NASA to do a life detection experiment on Mars. And because the only previous life detection experiment ever done was the Viking experiment in 1976, I was reviewing some of the old papers from then. And in fact, I was reviewing a particular paper in a journal called the Journal of Geophysical Research, which biologists almost never read. I'm trained as a circadian biologist. I study circadian rhythms. I was looking at this data from 76, and what I noticed, and what no one else had ever commented on at that point in time, was if you looked at the LR data, there was a very significant pattern in the data. Now, first I got to tell you about the LR experiment. LR stands for labeled release. And it was a very simple experiment. Basically, the Viking landers had little extendable arms on them that could scoop up a little bit of the Martian soil. The soil was then mixed with a nutrient solution of amino acids and other things that are known to encourage the growth of microbes on Earth. The little hook on all this was that the carbon atoms in all of the amino acids and whatnot were radio-labeled. Now, that meant that if there were any biological organisms capable of utilizing the nutrients that we provided chances are they would release some sort of gas as a metabolite. And it could be carbon dioxide, CO2, could be methane, CH4, could be anything that has a radioactive carbon atom in it. About 1 foot away from the little mixing chamber, there's a tube that was 1 foot long connected up to a radiation detector. The way it worked was, any time there was a radiation count, that meant that one molecule of a carbon-containing gas had been released from the soil nutrient mixture.
This is the soup test.
Yeah. So now, in the active experiments, basically that's all you did. You added the nutrient to the soil, and then you recorded the amount of gas released. In each of the active experiments, there was a tremendous increase in gas over the first several hours of the experiment, and then it would level off after that. Now, in control experiments, where the soil was sterilized by heating it to 160 degrees centigrade, or when the soil was stored in the dark for 4 months or more, which would presumably starve any organisms that might be in there. Basically, in those control conditions, when you added the nutrient, nothing happened, flat line. So you had to have a viable soil sample in order to see this effect. Okay, so that was all well known back in 1976. What I noticed was that when things leveled off after the first 6 hours or so, what you began to see from that point on were little oscillations in the gas, in the released gas signal. So you would see more gas released during the day, less gas released at night, and these oscillations would continue in some cases for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, that sort of daily oscillation is a circadian rhythm, which is my bread and butter. Mm-hmm. And why I got so excited, because I was the first person to see circadian rhythms in a data set from Mars. Circadian rhythms are a biological signature. Every organism on Earth has these rhythms, and they're present in every physiological or biochemical measure you want to talk about. Okay, they're pretty much ubiquitous in living organisms. What circadian means is approximately 24 hours, circa DN. So the reason we say approximate is because in a light-dark cycle, they're exactly 24 hours. But if you put animals or plants or any species you want in constant darkness, then you'll still see a rhythm, but it deviates a little bit from 24 hours. It could be 23 and a half, 24 and a half, whatever. But that means the fact that you continue to see this oscillation means it's intrinsic to the organism. It has nothing to do with the light-dark cycle. It's a basic internal clock. So basically, what I was seeing was evidence that potential Martian microbes also had these clocks, you know, very much like microbes on this planet. And then we were contacted by an Italian mathematician who was very interested in something that's called complexity mathematics. The study of complexity really boils down to the fact that living organisms are much more ordered. They have much more information content than they really should if they were purely physical processes.
And that was always the big question, wasn't it? Whether or not Viking was just getting readings from reactive soils, or whether it was something that was alive that was doing it.
Exactly. And, you know, we were aware of what was called the superoxide hypothesis, that there was something in the soil, some chemical, that was oxidizing all the carbon atoms, and basically the gas then would have just been CO2. But the problem was, the reason I never believed that, was because these little oscillations grew in magnitude, okay? You just wouldn't expect that from a chemical explanation. But if you had microbes that were, starting off with slightly different circadian periods, but getting synchronized over time to the temperature cycle, then you would expect to get larger and larger oscillations, which would, reflect the entire population of microbes as they became synchronized. So we think that what was happening was these microbes, these hypothetical microbes, were getting entrained to this temperature cycle, and that's why the rhythm, the amplitude of the rhythm would grow over time.
You wouldn't expect something like that from reactive soils, would you?
No, and we would also expect the chemical to still be there after heating it to 160 degrees or storing the soil sample in the dark for 4 months. I mean, the chemistry should still be there, and yet it wasn't. We saw no reaction when we used those control samples. You know, we couldn't call it the smoking gun because of this oxidizing hypothesis. So anyhow, several years later, this fellow got in touch with me about complexity math, And, you know, there was a Nobel Prize in this area that was awarded to a man whose name was Ilya Prigozhin quite a few years ago, who really made a big point out of how unusual it is for life to show so much order compared to all the non-physical phenomena, you know, on Earth. You know, life has tremendous amounts of information, the DNA. Why is that? And what Prigozhin said was that the reason is that the Earth is not a closed system. It's an open system, and it's sunlight that plants use to basically make all sorts of biological molecules. Animals eat, you know, we eat the plants, we eat the animals that eat the plants, and basically that energy is what allows us to operate so far from what's called equilibrium conditions. We exhibit complexity, we exhibit order. Life exhibits really less entropy than physical processes. That's the whole notion. What Prigozhin concentrated on was the entropy notion. Ultimately, this Italian mathematician and I used 7 different measures of whatever you want to call it, complexity or order, to analyze the data from Mars. And what we did was, you know, I don't want to go into the individual measurements because that's pretty pointy-headed. Just to make the discussion simple, I could just say that we were measuring Frambuzzle, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Frambuzzle, this hypothetical quantity, was much higher in the active experiments than in the control experiments on Mars. Now, all that says is that there's a difference between the active and control experiments. It doesn't prove that one is biology and the other one is not. However, the next step that we took was to take a variety of data series from Earth that were known to be either biological or non-biological. And these were known things. For instance, we had a circadian rhythm from a rat temperature series, things like that. So we threw all those data series into the pile with the Mars active experiments and the Mars control experiments. And then we used a technique that's called cluster analysis, which automatically sorts all of these data sets according to how similar they are. And what happened was two clusters fell out. In one cluster, all of the biological series from Earth were present and all the active experiments conducted on the Viking landers. The other cluster had all of the non-biological experiments known from Earth plus the control studies from the Viking lander. Okay, so basically in terms of Frambuzzle, there was a big difference in Frambuzzle between the biological and the non-biological data sets. Okay. And the Viking active data automatically had as much Frambuzzle as terrestrial biological data. So the obvious hypothesis then is that we're looking at the difference between biological and non-biological measures.
That's Associate Professor Joseph Miller from the University of Southern California. A new study of quasars has provided further evidence that dark energy will determine the ultimate fate of our universe. The data, reported in the Astronomical Journal, supports earlier studies by scientists including Nobel Physics Laureate Professor Brian Schmidt from the Australian National University, who found that the universe is expanding and that the rate of expansion is accelerating. Schmidt made his discovery while studying explosive stars known as Type 1a supernovae. The new work by scientists including Masamune Ogari from Japan's Kavelli Institute for the Physics and Mathematics of the Universe reached their findings by examining gravitationally lensed quasars, a different method to that used by Schmidt. Gravitational lensing involves the mass of a foreground object, such as a galaxy for example, acting as a lens by bending light coming towards us from a more distant background object. In this case, Ogari and colleagues used quasars, which are powerful particle and energy jets produced by supermassive black holes in the heart of galaxies from the early universe. They spent 10 years examining 100,000 quasars charted by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is developing a three-dimensional map of the universe. Ogari and colleagues eventually came up with a subset of gravitationally lensed quasars, allowing them to determine their likely frequency over a given area. Now, because accelerated expansion would increase the distance to each quasar, and therefore the chances of gravitational lensing, they were able to infer the expansion speed of the universe. Cosmologist Professor Charlie Lyon Weaver from the Australian National University says it's a new way to determine how fast the universe's expansion rate is accelerating.
Having a term like the cosmological constant changes the geometry of the universe. I know that's a little bit of a fuzzy word, but there's a relationship between how much space there is between us and a galaxy of a given redshift. Now, redshift is a way that we astronomers use to measure accurately distances, but it's not really distance. It's how much a galaxy has been shifted. The light from a galaxy has been shifted compared to a standard spectra. So basically, when you have this cosmological constant, this accelerating of the universe, that changes the distance between us and a galaxy of a given redshift. That means that the probability of lensing that galaxy is larger.
So there's a probability that you're more likely to find a lens, something between us and the galaxy if it's further away.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay. And
that's the whole trick. Here we're trying to measure the acceleration of the expansion, which is due to this term lambda, which has to do with the distance to that object, which is receding at a certain velocity.
This is another way of doing this, which lets you confirm the other methods that have been used, type 1A supernovae, baryonic acoustic oscillations.
Baryonic acoustic oscillations is one of them. The microwave background radiation is another. Another way is to do cluster counts as a function of redshift. There are quite a few different ways. Some of them are more accurate than others. The type 1 supernova that was used and got the Nobel Prize for the acceleration discovery is still the most accurate one.
That one depends on the likelihood of all type 1A supernovae being roughly the same brightness.
That's right.
How important is it to be able to verify other people's work using different methods?
That is tremendously important. All of science is built on that. I mean, you can imagine if one method gave you one answer and another method gave you another, and that would be okay. We had a big bun fight. But
they call that opera, don't they?
But what you're looking for in a result is, okay, I did it this way. I have this result based on supernova 1A. You have a cosmic microwave background. Do you get the same answer? Oh, yes, we do. Okay, good. Okay, how about you guys who are dealing with the age of the universe? That's okay. And so there's a series of 6, 7, 8 increasingly indirect ways that can be shown to be consistent with this. And that's why many of us have so much confidence that this accelerating universe and the presence of a cosmological constant are very solid science. I mean, the Nobel Prize is not awarded on kind of flaky evidence. The result of an accelerating universe has already been confirmed 5, 6, 7 times, but this is a new way that is, and it's always great to have a new way to confirm something. And it's not, you know, we're always worried about the systematic errors associated with any individual way of measuring things have systematic errors, and we don't like those, and we're scared of them, as the recent results for the neutrinos that go faster than light showed. That was shown to be wrong about a month ago because they hadn't screwed in some wire to a GPS unit tightly enough, and these are things that are really the enemies of good science, and yet that's why independent confirmation is so very important, and that's what this does.
That's Professor Charlie Lineweaver, a cosmologist with the Australian National University. The Square Kilometre Array Organisation has appointed a committee which will consider splitting the world's largest radio telescope project between Australia and New Zealand and South Africa. The Australian and New Zealand bid has been competing against South Africa to host the Square Kilometre Array, which will be 50 times more sensitive than any radio telescope ever built. However, Professor Fred Watson from the Australian Astronomical Observatory warns that splitting the array could result in some technical problems. He's speaking with the ABC's Timothy MacDonald.
I don't know whether a compromise on a large scale, and by that I mean to try and split the SKA between two host nations and, well, actually more than nations, but two host regions, I think that might be a compromise that some radio astronomers would find unacceptable. There's a lot of vested interest in actually keeping the integrity of the arrays as they were originally planned.
So are there technical issues with dividing it across an expanse as large as the Indian Ocean?
Yeah, that I believe is the case. There are already telescopes, radio telescopes in the world that can do this sort of thing, that can span oceans. In fact, there are radio telescopes that actually link antennas in space to antennas on the ground. But one of the strengths of the SKA as it was planned was the geometrical arrangement of the arrays themselves. To do the thing the way the instrument was planned, I think really requires the full investment to go on one site. But I think that a compromise might not be seen as perhaps the best way forward for this.
Where do you believe that the Australian bid was at prior to this? I guess there had been some leaks suggesting that SKA was leaning towards South Africa.
There were leaks, that's right. There were leaks, yes, indeed they said exactly that, that the bid was leaning towards Southern Africa rather than to Australia. But in the trade, as it were, we were all aware that that was nothing more than a leak. It was simply one interim report of one of the committees. So there was a great caution in discussing that leak. It's not the final answer, and it looks as though we haven't reached the final answer yet.
The statement that came out of SKA's meeting said that they want to recognise the fairly large investments made by both candidates. Does this suggest that perhaps they're leaning towards a solution that's more political than scientific, perhaps?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. It sounds almost more economic because those investments are made by the scientific funding bodies in both countries. They were designed actually to be investments that would stand alone in the event of the SKA itself going to the other country. Not leaning towards a political outcome so much as kind of scientific economic one. I think if, for example, the decision had gone in South Africa's favour, the Australian Guekalemie Array Pathfinder would have been further developed and would produce remarkable scientific data, probably again in conjunction with the SKA across the other side of the world. But it's really a difficult call because we are working on very little information here, and I guess everybody has had at the back of their mind that there might be a political dimension to this, but the hope has always been that it will be the science that would dictate the best site for the telescope to go on.
It sounds like you're also suggesting that if Australia were to lose the bid, it wouldn't be a dead loss.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. It would be a great disappointment, of course, but certainly wouldn't be a dead loss at all. Absolutely not.
Professor Fred Watson from the Australian Astronomical Observatory, and he was speaking there with the ABC's Timothy MacDonald. North Korea's controversial Galaxy 3 rocket launch has been a failure. Reports indicate the Galaxy 3, or Unha 3 in Korean, crashed and burned just 90 seconds after launch. First to second stage separation failure is being blamed for the mishap. However, that's raised some questions because the first stage burn time is actually 120 seconds, which means the second stage may have ignited while the first stage was still attached and firing. Reports claim the missile and its payload broke into four parts, with the burning debris falling into the Yellow Sea some 200 kilometres off the western South Korean coastline. The highly publicised failure of what Pyongyang claimed was the launch of an orbital rocket with a weather satellite has dealt a massive blow to the prestige of the reclusive and impoverished nation. The North Koreans had defied strong international pressure from the United States, Japan, South Korea, and the G8 to push ahead with the launch, which even its closest ally, China, warned against. Critics believe the flight was actually a ballistic missile test designed to enhance the capabilities of North Korea to design a long-range rocket delivery system for a thermonuclear warhead. The flight was North Korea's second consecutive failure to get a satellite into orbit, although it attempted to claim success with the previous launch in 2009. The Unha 3 rocket took off from a new launch facility on the west coast of North Korea near the Chinese border. The launch had been timed to coincide with the 100th birthday celebrations of the communist state's founder Kim Il-sung. The Unha 3 is a 32-metre tall, 85-ton three-stage rocket with a 7,000-kilometre range. The first stage is based on the Taipodong 2 ballistic missile. It's powered by a cluster of four Taipodong 1 enhanced liquid-fueled Soviet Scud missile engines. The second stage is based on a Soviet-era SS-9 submarine-launched liquid-fueled ballistic missile. The third stage is still somewhat of a mystery. Sources believe it may be a solid rocket fuel propellant, an Iranian Safir ballistic missile second stage, which is propelled by two small gimbaled rocket engines. Despite the failure, North Korea insists it will go ahead with a new, bigger rocket launch as part of a five-year space program. Reports in a pro-Pyongyang newspaper quoted an unnamed official involved in the North's rocket program as saying Pyongyang would develop a bigger rocket than the one which was launched last week. North Korea has been developing missiles for decades now, both for what it terms self-defense and as a lucrative export commodity. In fact, that's where Saddam Hussein got all his scuds from. India has announced plans to test fly its own long-range missile, the Agni 5. The new intercontinental ballistic missile is capable of carrying a nuclear warhead over a range of 5,000 kilometres. In the latest display of India's growing military prowess, the test of the Agni 5 will be carried out from a coastal rocket range in the eastern state of Orissa. The new rocket would, in theory, be capable of striking targets across Asia as well as some parts of Europe. Currently, only China, Russia, France, the United States, Great Britain and Israel are thought to have such long-distance nuclear missile capabilities. The latest announcement follows last November's test flight of an Agni 4 missile, which can travel 3,500 kilometres and is capable of carrying a one-ton thermonuclear warhead deep inside China. India is among the world's top 10 military spenders, with Jane's Defence Weekly forecasting its total purchases between 2011 and 2015 will top $100 billion. India's fought three wars with arch-rival Pakistan since independence in 1947, but China is now viewed as the main focus of India's military concerns. India staged a string of nuclear detonations in 1998 and declared itself a nuclear weapons state, but it's refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And time now to once again turn our eyes to the skies. Nick Lom is Curator of Astronomy with the Powerhouse Museum's Sydney Observatory. And he joins us now as we continue checking out the nights of April on Skywatch.
Let us move further in our tour of the April night sky, and let us move to the southern part of the sky. High up in the southeast, we can see the constellation of Southern Cross. Of course, the Southern Cross is a very obvious constellation in night sky, and a constellation of great significance to Australians. To make sure that we're looking at the real Southern Cross and not the false cross, which is somewhere high up in the southern sky, it's important to look for the two stars directly below, the two pointer stars. As well, we can note that the stars of the real cross are brighter than the stars of the false cross, and they're closer together, much more compact than the stars of the false cross. The two-pointer stars are known as Alpha and Beta Centauri. The lower one of the two pointers is called Alpha Centauri, and it is a star system that is closest to us in the sky. Light left Alpha Centauri 4 1/3 years ago, and it is reaching us today. If you look at Alpha Centauri through a small telescope, it is a very spectacular double star, two stars that are close together in the field of view of the telescope. It is actually a third star in the system. It's only recognizable by careful study of actual images of that part of the night sky. This third star is believed to be circling around the other two, and the current state of its paths around the two main stars of Alpha Centauri means that it's slightly closer to us than the other two stars. Hence, astronomers have given this star the name Proxima Centauri, meaning that it's a close-by star of Centauri. Proxima Centauri is the closest star to us, but the closest star system is Alpha Centauri, because Proxima is part of the same system. Above the pointers, as we've discussed, we find the bright stars of the Southern Cross. If we take the topmost star of the Southern Cross and the one on the right, and we extend the line through them towards the right, we move towards the west and we reach the bright star Canopus that is almost overhead, very high up in the southern sky. Canopus is the second brightest star in the sky after Sirius. It is a star that's 312 light years from us, and because it appears bright even at large distance, we can tell that it's intrinsically a very bright star. Astronomers have established that it gives off about 10,000 times as much energy as our own Sun. It is a very light star, about 100 times the width of our own Sun. The name Canopus comes from the name of a pilot of a fleet in ancient Greek times, and this fleet was sailing back from Troy after the battle there at Troy. According to ancient Greek legends, the name of the pilot was Canopus, and it seems the fleet pulled into the port of Alexandria in Egypt, and Canopus died at that port. At this place, the star Canopus was just visible over the horizon, so it was named after the pilot who had died in the city of Alexandria. Canopus is the brightest star in the constellation of Carina the Keel, and the Keel refers to the ship Argo Navis, the constellation known as the ship. Argo Navis was once the largest constellation in that part of the sky, but it has since been broken up into three, Carina, Vela de Sails, and Pupis, which is the stern of the ship. The Milky Way passes through the northeastern part of these three constellations and contains many interesting clusters of stars and nebulae, which are sorts of fuzzy objects in the night sky. The most famous of these fuzzy objects is called Eta Carinae, or the Eta Carinae Nebula. This nebula is a large cloud of gas and dust surrounding the star, also called Eta Carinae. This is one of the largest stars we know about in the night sky. It is at least 350 times the mass of our own sun. The star is famous because in the 1830s and 40s, it experienced an outburst and suddenly became very much brighter than it had been previously. During the outburst, it became the second brightest star in the night sky after Sirius. We should note, though, that Sirius is only 9 light-years away. Eta Carinae is 7,500 light-years away from us. Hence, intrinsically, Eta Carinae is a much, much brighter star than Sirius. It had to become intrinsically extremely bright in the 1840s to appear in our night sky almost as bright as Sirius. During the outburst in the 1830s and 40s, Eta Carinae threw out a lot of dust, and that dust has formed a cocoon around the star and hides it from our view. That is why the star has become much fainter than it was in the 1830s and 40s. Intrinsically, the star is still bright, but it's inside the dust cloud, which hides it from our view. Infrared radiation is still transmitted through the dust, though. This dust creates its own infrared radiation, and Eta Carinae is the brightest source of infrared radiation in the night sky. There's a very famous and spectacular image by the Hubble Space Telescope of this cocoon of dust surrounding the star. In recent times, astronomers have determined that Eta Carinae is not just a single star, but it's two massive stars circling around each other. One of them is just over 100 times as much massive as our own sun, and the other one is probably a little less than 100 times as massive as our own sun. These two stars circling around each other roughly every 5 years. As these stars are so massive, they're believed to be near the end of their life cycles. Eta Carinae is the best candidate we have for a star about to go supernova, that is, to explode at the end of its lifetime. As light takes 7,500 years to reach us from Eta Carinae, it's quite possible that one of the stars have already exploded and created a supernova, but that is something we will not know until the light actually reaches us. Certainly, it is a prime candidate to be a supernova sometime between now and the next 10 or 20,000 years. If it does become a supernova, it will become very, very spectacular, and not only become the brightest object in the night sky, rivaling and possibly becoming even brighter than the moon, but will be visible even during daylight for months on end.
That's Nick Lom, Curator of Astronomy with the Powerhouse Museum's Sydney Observatory. For more details, go to sydneyobservatory.com.au. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.